Marvin Landsberg, and this session is part of the series on Blake. It's been going on this week, although each one of these stands alone. But the title of the series is Hearing Wisdom, Seeing Wisdom, Speaking Wisdom, Blake and the Bible. And this particular session is called, it's something like The Parables of Jesus and William Blake. That's it. And what I'd like to do first, just to get us going, since thanks to Grace and a few other things, I got a copy of this tape we were talking about last time, where Greg Brown, who some of you know, the Iowa folk singer, is singing Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. So just to get us in the Blake mood, I'll flash up the song that he's singing, which is A Tiger. And I think what I'll do is just click through it in a few of some of the Blake's other poems while he's singing this particular one. But since the slide's not that great, I won't leave it up here the whole time. That is mine, right there.
We have to leave, Lois.
A lot of you probably know Greg Brown, have heard him on Prairie Home Companion. Garrison Keillor likes him a lot. I mean, it just shows you, William Blake, the person we're talking about today, I mean, shows up in popular culture frequently, and in many ways he pops up, he inspires artists. There's even an opera that has some Blake in it. He's one of those figures that continues to grab the attention of artists. So. There's worse ways to start off than listening to Greg Brown, certainly. What you should have as your tools for the day is the handout, which is a copy of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, the text of it, which is one of Blake's works that we'll be reading a few of his stories from, his parables, as this session is titled. And if you have a Bible somewhat handy, it would be helpful. And I have some in here. If you walked in late, you might not have grabbed one, and it would help, so I'm going to grab a few. Okay, thanks. One time when I was giving a final for a class, I don't think it had any Blake in the class. I teach English at Montana State University, for those of you who don't know me.
I go to U
of M. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's... If we were in the state of Montana, I would have got a boo from you.
Come on.
Anyway, I was giving a final, and I was late for the final. The whole class was in there, impatient, all looking at their notes, studying, last-minute studying before this test. As I walked up to the door, I could hear one of them say, "If he doesn't get here soon, we're going to actually start learning this stuff." And I keep thinking, the more time I spend with William Blake's work, and if the more I keep talking about it, someday I'm hoping I'll begin to understand it a little better, or even better, what I'm hoping today is to give you a chance to talk about some of this stuff. And because that's really the point, not just sitting there listening to someone talk about it, but doing some talking about it yourself, and tying that into speech. The series title, Hearing Wisdom, is part of it, but Speaking Wisdom is really the be-all, end-all for Blake. And I'll explain just how he's thinking about that in a minute. But where I'd like to start is in the Bible, just a quick look at some of Jesus' parables and how the form of them is set up and how Blake was inspired by the type of storytelling that Jesus did. And then we'll shift to some of Blake's weird stories, and some of them don't make sense, some of them are a joke, some of them are supposed to be funny, but all of them have a very serious connection to biblical wisdom and ultimately to knowing God through speaking about it. And I feel like I should at least just get us situated again for those of you who haven't been to another session. I mean, William Blake is the late 18th century visionary poet, radical Protestant painter, engraver, whose illuminated books you were looking at in the slides up there, those are from his Songs of Innocence and Experience for Children. And later, he wrote the series of what they're called prophetic books, books of poetry and art, which he hoped people would read and would help call them back to the proper way of God. And looking around Blake, looking around his London in the 18th century, he didn't like much of what he saw. Growing materialism, secularization of society, dehumanization, people getting booted off the farms and coming into working in factories. And he saw much in modern society that he thought was against Christianity. And so it continues to speak to us, I think, living sort of in the aftermath of that. Now, just I want to get our nose in the Bible for a minute, and anytime you got any question along the way, just jump right in and feel free to.
Those drawings are actually his own.
Yeah. So as an artist engraver, he would engrave those and the text together on one plate and then publish them himself. So where I want to start is in Mark chapter 4. This is where Jesus begins his set of parables that he's telling by the sea, and he starts this first series of parables. This is one that's familiar to everybody. I'm not going to read the whole thing. What I'm interested in is just the patterning that's going on in here. The song we just heard sung about the tiger has a line in it, fearful symmetry. The question at the end and in the middle, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? I mean, that line really, it is a perfect one for the way Blake thinks. That notion of symmetry, patterning things in relationship to each other, and it's not a perfect symmetry, it's a fearful symmetry, which I'm not sure exactly what that means, but what it means most often in his sense is, I dare you to find the relationship between these things that I'm putting up in front of you. And what I've been exploring all week is the relationship between Blake's works and biblical wisdom, which he's constantly asking you to look for, the relationship between his songs, his later works, and the book of Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, the books in the biblical wisdom tradition, which Blake will read the Bible in an energetic, radical Protestant way, which means the Bible's been put into the hands of the people, and the people have been authorized to read it, and he will read it in his own fashion, not wanting anyone to tell him exactly what it means. So he'll read it in a very creative way. And when anybody asks me, why should we look at Blake? Why should we be interested in Blake? So what? My answer to that question, and especially up here, is that Blake provides for me a model of reading Scripture and of reading anything, but in particular Scripture, that where I don't always agree with his conclusions or his interpretations, it's a model of reading where his dictum really is, try to read as energetically as I do. And I think, as we'll see, that really ties into to the heart of how Blake sees what Jesus' message itself was. So, to Mark 4, I'm just going to read a little bit at the beginning and skip down to a couple places that I'd point to. So starting at the beginning. Again, he began to teach beside the sea. Such a very large crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat on the sea and sat there while the whole crowd was beside the sea on the land. And in his he began to teach them many things in parables. And in his teaching, he said to them, listen, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell on the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Other seed fell on the rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and it sprang up quickly, since it had no depth of soil, and when the sun rose, it was scorched, and since it had no root, it withered away. Other seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. Other seed fell into the good soil and brought forth grain, growing up and increasing, and yielding 30 and 60 and 100 fold. And he said, let anyone with ears to hear listen. So you've got this story framed by these commands. Pay attention. Listen. Hear this. And as it goes on, this relationship, especially here and in the other Gospels too, with the disciples who don't get it. So it goes on in verse 10. When he was alone, those who were around him, along with the 12, asked him about the parables. And he said to them, to you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside, everything comes in parables, in order that, and then he quotes from the Hebrew scriptures to fulfill prophecy, that they may indeed look but not perceive, that they may indeed listen but not understand. So Jesus tells a story, and what I'm interested in here, and what I'm interested in is what I see sort of Blake doing. It's not so much the content of this parable, but Jesus is explaining all kinds of the big questions. What's God? What's heaven? Who am I? And he tells a story. There's always people around that don't get it. And then sometimes he explains the meaning. So he says, okay, I'll give it to you. And sometimes the text that we have here doesn't give it to us. It just says he told it to them. But then as this one goes on, we get Jesus doing some hermeneutics of his own story. It says, okay, here's how you read that story. This is this, this is this, this is this, and this is this. And he explains what the seed is, and what the rocky ground is, and you know, the interpretation of the parable. So he's explaining the answer to it. And my interest here is the relationship between the parable, the story, and the explanation, presumably what it means, the meaning of it. And the meaning of the story sometimes is put forth in sort of the most reduced form possible, which sometimes appears as proverbs. So you have parables as the story that has some air of mystery about it, and the mystery is explained through a set of proverbs, the pithy wisdom explanation. Does that make sense? So you've got story and explanation, and then the explanation, the wisdom statement, explains what it means. But I think what Blake is interested in is something that's in the heart of the Greek and Hebrew notion of what a parable is. And the Greek term parable means, what, do you remember? Some of you remember this. Maybe you don't. To throw beside. To throw one thing next to another is what parable means. So if you say the kingdom of God is like, well, what? Well, I'll throw something next to that and we'll see what happens. So that's what Jesus' method is doing. He's throwing one thing next to another and he's making comparisons of heaven to this, or faith to a mustard seed, all the comparisons that he makes. I mean that's an interesting term, to throw one thing beside another. It has a little bit of an anarchic aspect to it, or serendipity, luck. The term for parable in Hebrew is mashal, which is the exact same term used for proverb. And that's what interests me. And Blake played around with some Hebrew. He didn't know a lot, but I suspect he knew that the term in Hebrew for both parable and proverb was the same thing. They didn't make a distinction, as we would, between one that's making extended comparison with a story, and the proverb, which is making a comparison in a short sentence fashion. Blake is interested in how Jesus, working in that tradition, keeps his parables and proverbs always interconnected, so that he doesn't always seem to be working from story, then explaining the meaning, always, although he certainly is here. But every once in a while, say, oh, you don't get that, you don't understand my explanation, then I'll give you another parable. Instead of just trotting out more explanations of meanings, he gives you another parable, which is what he does here. So following this one, after the explanation, he said to them, and I'm on verse 21 now, is a lamp brought in to be put under the bushel basket or under the bed and not on the lampstand? So there's this little light of mine source, one of them. And that is, I mean, is that a parable?
That's a parable form. I mean that's a proverb form.
Yeah, I mean that's a question there. It's the question form of the proverb that you'll see frequently used in the book of Job, where people are asking proverbial questions to each other, where you're making this comparison and you're asking it as a question. And that's constantly used in Job, where people are asking each other these questions. So he's saying, is a lamp brought in to be put under the bushel basket or under the bed and not on the lampstand? So this proverbial question, the fact that it's in the form of a question intrigues Blake, because when you pose it as a question, it's not beating you overhead with the meaning anymore. It's keeping things open. And if Blake wanted anything, it was always to keep things open. Couple more quick points and we'll get to the Blake part of this. Jesus in this set continues to emphasize hearing. And these are the lines that fascinate me, partly because I read them with Blake's eyes. Jesus says, for there is nothing hidden except to be disclosed. So, I mean, all mysteries, and this is part of the gospel lesson, I mean, it isn't a secret religion, it isn't a secret, you have to follow me around and find all the Gnostic information to find out about the kingdom of heaven. All these mysteries will be revealed and will come to light. It says, let anyone with ears to hear listen. So there's that motto again. And the next line he finally says, and he said to them, pay attention to what you hear. The measure you give will be the measure you get, and still more will be given you. For to those who have, more will be given, and from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. Now, those two lines are the ones I think Blake picks up on. And what does that mean to you? What are those two lines? I mean, that seems to run counter to the other theme tied up with the parables that Jesus tells about the last will be first and the first will be last. That's the one we remember. The guy that gets in the front of the line gets shoved to the back because he's crowding to the front. And here Jesus is saying, pay attention to what you hear. What you give will be what you get. And to those who have, you'll get even more. And to those who have nothing, even that will be taken away. What does that mean? You ever heard that explained? Or, I mean, how do you even read that? What's he saying there? This isn't a rhetorical proverbial question. I want you to tell me. Yeah.
The parable of the talents of the minutes, with the one who had 5, 10, the one who did nothing, but it was taken away.
Yeah.
It seems like this is at the end of the wrong parable.
Yeah.
But I mean, it explains that parable.
And this line shows up after some other ones, too. I mean that seems to follow that one. I mean, remember that parable, it sounds like a good authorization for capitalism. So, I mean, if you're a good investor, you'd be rewarded, and that's what Jesus is saying God likes. I'm not sure exactly that's what it means. I hope it doesn't mean that exactly.
It doesn't mean taking risks. Okay, so take risks. So those who take risks will be rewarded.
If the risks are for the kingdom.
Yeah.
And in that one, the guy that hid it and gave back what he was given, he was the one that didn't do the parable you just spoke of. That was wrong. And this, what you just read, starts out, are you supposed to hide this lamp under a bushel? Mm-hmm. So we've got some connection. You're not supposed to hide things.
There's a sense, it seems to me, in this, that of God's kingdom is a kingdom of grace, that things happen. You know, you do a little bit and more happens. You don't do anything, nothing happens. And the next part here is the kingdom of God is like a man who should scatter seed upon the ground. He should sleep and rise 9 days. He really does very little. He just scatters seed, sleeps, mm-hmm. and rises, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's there. He doesn't really know how it got there.
Right. So what I'm hoping my garden back home is doing while we're here at home.
But grace sort of happens when you don't even... You do something, more gets to you somehow. You don't really know how.
What I always want to do is insert a word in the variable that's left out there. I mean, for those who have what, even more will be given to them. For those who, fill in the blank. For those who have money, well, it's not that.
Faith.
I mean, faith works very well there, doesn't it?
Understanding.
For those who have understanding, they will even understand things more. Yeah. I
mean, wisdom.
Wisdom.
Or the word, which is what is scattered earlier.
Yeah. And I mean, that the word certainly fits, and it'll fit with what Blake is wanting to do with this. The word imagination, I mean, as a romantic poet, is one I think Blake would want to put there. For those who have imagination, they will get even more imagination. And for those deadheads who have no imagination, they will have what little they have taken away from them. Now, I mean, certainly sticking that word in there is reading the gospel through, I mean, perhaps different eyes than exegetes who want to say what exactly is going on here in the text itself, I mean, when this was written. And yet that's not the way Blake is going to inquire and read the Bible to say what exactly was meant by those people writing it then. And he wants to interact with the text. And what I'd just like to put it in front of you, that I think imagination really is one of the things that he's thinking about there. Faith, those other terms, he has also got in mind. But also what Jesus is saying here in the line, listen, pay attention to what you hear. That sounds also like something like, don't listen to false prophets, it's dangerous. Or pay attention to the correct wisdom, don't listen to the incorrect wisdom. Because correct wisdom can take you somewhere, incorrect wisdom can lead you away. I think that's not the way Blake would think. Pay attention to what you hear. Blake is going to tie into not just hearing, but speaking. And that's where I want to get into this business about speaking. What is Jesus talking about what you hear, what you listen to? Blake's got an answer for that. And before I flash on what that answer is, just one more quick comment about one thing that Jesus is doing here that I think it seems to me that is the case, and going to Fred Niedner's Bible studies last week, I've heard more support for that Jesus is responding himself to the wisdom tradition in making that statement. The book of Proverbs is a wisdom book which says, its basic problem is repeated over and over and over again, is if you're good, you'll be rewarded, and if you're bad, you'll be punished. It's constantly saying that in material sounding terms, the good will be rewarded on earth, the bad will be punished. God's in heaven, God, this is an orderly place, this is an orderly world, and that's how the world will work. And Jesus here is tapping into that and saying much the same thing in that line, but not quite the same thing. So that principle in the book of Proverbs in the wisdom tradition is the principle of distributive justice. You'll get what you deserve, which is a concept I think Blake is interested in, but you'll get what you deserve can also be an oppressive law rather than what Jesus is doing here with it. So let's take a look at what Blake's answer to what you have more of will be good for you if it's not money. And... let's see, where's my copy of the thing? Did I end up on? You still have one? I need a copy of the marriage. Oh, I'll just read it out here.
Good.
Oh, thanks. I'd like you to turn to plate 11. I'll just flash a couple slides on here so you know what it is you're looking at. You just have the text. You don't have the full sort of artifact or even a facsimile. I did give you one black and white reproduction, but it doesn't do justice to it. You see, there's the title page, which you see in front of you. So Blake is, again, doing this illuminated book. And each page has decorations to it. And we don't have time to talk about all the ins and outs of what he's drawing, but I just want to at least give you a feeling for what it is. I mean, we're interested in the stories here more than the decoration. But you can see there's all kinds of references in his designs that helps make sense of the stories. And some of the references in the designs, they look like they have nothing to do with what's going on in the story, so it's additional useful information. So that's some of them. The title page, I can't let this pass without just saying one quick thing about it. Blake's title pages are fascinating. What I'm interested in here, and I still don't know if I'm nuts. I've been writing about this now enough that it will be determined fairly soon whether I'm nuts or not. And you can help me. But what I've been interested in this title page for a long time, this isn't directly related to what we're talking about, but I have to do my sanity goal. So, it is that shape in that tree right there. The received title of this poem is The Marriage of Hell. Blake talks about it. But there's something there that's not just a tree. Can you see that?
No.
An elephant. Hey, everybody, I mean, when you start looking at it, you might see something different, but it seems like one of those symbols.
It's a good Republican.
Yeah. He would have been a Tory. I don't think he...
Yeah.
It was John Bull instead. But the marriage of what I see there, that shape, is a Q, an inverted Q, so it's a little bit backwards. Can you sort of see that? I mean, if it's a Q, it could even have an S, a backwards S. I don't know. I mean, and this one is even stranger. But look at this right here. The marriage of, there's of, if you turn F into a P, can you see anything emerging out of those squiggles? Forget the O. The marriage O, and there's a P, and there's the rest. You see it there? A word hidden.
Plato.
You see it? The marriage of Plato?
Yeah.
Plato would have been the beginning of the industrial stuff that he's even like.
Blake has a very dualistic way of thinking, which I don't really want to talk about. But he hates religion, which functions in a very platonic fashion that separates body from soul, heaven from hell. That's what this whole thing is about, is marrying the two together, because that's true religion. It's an incarnation theology. But Jesus is the heart and soul of it. So, I mean, there's some interest in seeing Plato there. I don't know if that's there. I think it may be nuts. But I think that Q is hanging in the tree, and for good reasons, that ties into the wisdom tradition. This is my 30-second answer, because I want to read some parables. But Q, the speaker of Ecclesiastes, which is what I'll be talking about tomorrow and Friday, the book of Ecclesiastes and what Blake does with that and something else, is identified as the preacher. In Hebrew is Koheleth. Preacher, teacher, Koheleth. Koheleth, Blake knew enough, had access to enough Hebrew, that I think he knew that the speaker of Proverbs was Koheleth. And there's a sort of an emblem for the speaker of this book, which is full of Proverbs. And these aren't biblical, especially ecclesiastical Proverbs. These are inverted ones, because Blake is giving you some sort of infernal wisdom, so he flips his cue around as this kind of hidden little symbol. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. You can someday mention it when you have a copy of this, of your very own, and show it to someone, and they'll say, "You're nuts." Anyway, so I'll flip that off so I won't be tempted to say anything else. And what I want to do is
is that look at plate, what did I say, 11. So Jesus is saying, be careful what you hear. And Blake's, what this is in front of you is it's a bunch of seemingly disconnected things. I mean, if you're just flipping your way on your way to plate 11, which is on page, 38. On your way there, you'll go through this list of the Proverbs of Hell, which is a long list of 70 Proverbs. Famous Proverbs where Blake is responding to some biblical ones and correcting them and saying, this is how it really is. I mean, you can take this home with you and you can look at them sometime. But then he gets, after those, he just starts sticking in these things that he calls memorable fancies. So you can see on plate 12, it says a memorable fancy. Those are little stories which he wants you to read like you would read a parable from Jesus. He's throwing one thing beside another. And he's also throwing proverbs next to parables and showing how they are constantly interacting with each other. And the story that he's constantly telling is this one. Is there any more? Are we out?
Since I've interrupted.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
But one of the stories that Blake is constantly telling in his parables in here, and we'll look at one and then I want to look at what he does to some other words of Jesus, is to tell the story of what inevitably happens to the spoken word. And I think this is why he thinks Jesus is so interested in that, in the word, and saying, listen, pay attention to this. Not because what I'm saying is a truth and I'm bonking you over the head with it and you have to memorize it and put it between the covers of book and teach it in confirmation classes. Instead, the story that Blake is telling here is a story of human society, whenever they have words, and especially divine speech, humans will always take that divine speech, institutionalize it, and kill it. By institutionalizing it, it will take the soul out of it. And that use of language in a God fashion will have this performative, or will have this prophetic aspect to it, but as soon as it's institutionalized, it will turn into something else. And one way to think about that is, in the terms of a proverb, Blake's proverbs function, and this is going to be just a couple of quick jargon terms, but it's useful for me. Blake's proverbs function as performative utterances. And a performative utterance is an utterance that does, in the act of speaking, what it refers to. So if a king says, I decree that this is the law, that's a performative utterance. You're not describing something, it's doing something and saying it. So when you say, I pronounce you man and wife or whatever, woman, the language. I mean, it's that formalistic act of speaking it that's a performative utterance. And a performative utterance is the speech of God. I mean, the ultimate performative utterancer is God, who says, let there be light, and there's light. Now, that focus on language certainly is part of the Gospel of John, where John opens with the description of the word. How does it go?
In the beginning was the word.
Yeah. I mean, that focus on word again, that word is potent. And what Blake is constantly telling the story of is how that potent word gets stuck into a church, and the church gets organized, and they start fighting with each other, and pretty soon it's not the word anymore. So a couple of these parables to see how that's functioning. Finally, we get to Blake. Plate 11.
Good.
The ancient poets, okay, yeah. The ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by the names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And remember, this is just, there's no introduction. Blake is just giving you a long list of proverbs, and all of a sudden he's just telling you this. So he's talking about ancient poets animating things. And particularly, they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity. Till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects, thus began priesthood. Choosing forms of worship from poetic tales. And at length, they pronounced,
I didn't underline the word, that the gods had ordered such things, thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast. So there's a quick parable about what in the world has happened. Now, one way always to read what Blake is up to is look for connections, and he's always thinking about connections to biblical stories and other places. I mean, when you read that one, I mean, does that make you think of anything else, or do you see any connections, or what does it say? And by asking that question, it's an important Blakean question, because for me, just to sit here and continue talking is completely beside the point. I mean, partly what Blake wants always is people to speak. Read this and say something. Don't read this, go off and do it yourself. But anybody?
Reminds me of Jesus saying that the temple is within us, not. Deities reside within the human breast.
Once God is institutionalized, you lose
him. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the moral of this story, too. If you institutionalize God, I mean, again, when talking about, I mean, in the Bible study this week and last, Christology and other things, what's God? So Walt was talking about, I mean, God is an abstraction. In terms of talk about God, once you think the language is equivalent to God, I mean, and you're not realizing that it's a metaphor, would be one way of saying, I mean, Blake thinks it's poetry. It doesn't answer all the questions, but I mean, certainly it means something to Blake here. If you don't treat it as poetry, and you treat it as something that gets abstracted, that's the word he hates the most from 18th century philosophy around him, it's in bad shape.
This sounds to me a little like maybe the precursor to Nietzsche saying, God is dead and we have killed him.
Yeah.
This is like saying we created God.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, I mean, we created him, although, I mean, I think Blake wouldn't make quite that statement with some of the implications that it has for us now. But certainly, Jesus is the incarnate God. I mean, there's a little bit of what we also call transcendentalism here later on in this continent that sounds like what Blake's up to. But what's interesting to me also is this: he tells a story, and then he ends it with a proverb. Thus, all men forgot. Men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast. I mean, it's the relationships that's as important as the message that's being told here. Now, read this next one, which is labeled A Memorable Fancy. So page 38, it's talking about the prophets. The prophets, Isaiah and Ezekiel, dined with me. And the speaker here is Blake, sort of. It's also his devil who's running around here, who is not a satanic devil, but someone who really understands the Bible, as opposed to this angel who's a member of an institutionalized church that's too worried about arcane Lutheran or whatever theology rather than the real thing. So the prophets Isaiah and Ezekiel dined with me, and I asked them how they dared so roundly to assert that God spake to them. You'll notice there's weird punctuation. This weird punctuation is Blake's. And whether they did not think that at the time that they would be misunderstood and so be the cause of imposition. Isaiah answered, I saw no God, nor heard any, in a finite, organical perception. But my senses discovered the infinite in everything, and as I was then persuaded and remained confirmed that the voice of honest indignation is the voice of God, I cared not for the consequences, but wrote. That's, I mean, an interesting phrase. So I didn't care what happened. I wrote, prophetic speech is the voice of God. And he goes on with his question and answer. Then I ask, does a firm persuasion that a thing is so make it so? He replied, all poets believe that it does. And in ages of imagination, this firm persuasion removed mountains. You see a reference there? I mean, what's that?
Faith.
Yeah, I mean, there's the reference to, I mean, if you have the faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. But many are not capable of a firm persuasion of anything. Then Ezekiel said, the philosophy of the East taught the first principles of human perception. Some nations held one principle for the origin and some another,
We of Israel taught that the poetic genius, as you now call it, was the first principle and all the others merely derivative, which was the cause of our despising the priests and philosophers of other countries, and prophesying that all gods would at last be proved to originate in ours and be the tributaries of the poetic genius. It was this that our great poet King David desired so fervently and invoked so pathetically, saying, by this he conquers enemies and governs kingdoms, and we so loved our God, that we cursed in his name all the deities of the surrounding nations and asserted that they had rebelled. From these opinions, the vulgar came to think that all nations would at last be subject to the Jews. Now, that's sort of a long paragraph. Can you follow his reasoning? So he's saying, okay, Ezekiel's giving this quick story saying, well, here's how things work. We talked about our God, monotheism. I mean, our God was the God who's better than all the other gods. And you can call it whatever you want, since God's a metaphor. Why don't we call it poetic genius for a minute, which is sort of Blake's term that he's going to use. And he's saying, Ezekiel and Isaiah were so successful in saying our God is the only God that what was the truth then for them becomes an imposition on others, because when times change, when things change, when cultures change and people change, it's no longer exactly the truth anymore. Does that make sense? Same process. Words, living speech, held on to, hold on to the myth, the story. And when circumstances change, you can hold on to the story, the myth at the heart of it, but it's no longer connected in the same way to things, and pretty soon you have this brittle shell, and no longer do you have the incarnation, that is, the Word made flesh, the story and its meaning wrapped up together. Another way to say that would be, you've got a performative, which Blake never uses that word, it wasn't invented when he was writing, but what Blake's talking about here, firm persuasion. I mean, I have a firm persuasion that something is true, and they're speaking it. And by speaking it, it happens, and it's successful. And it's so successful, everybody believes it. And that's the process of degradation of performatives into affirmatives. And it's inevitable and will always happen. So what Blake does, he tells that story over and over and over again. Partly because if you tell that story once and say, this is what happened, it's not what happened, and the same thing that Blake is accusing others of, he would be guilty of, is telling one story that people say, oh, this is the truth here. Just to peek back at plate 11 for a minute, and some of the other references, when he's talking about these ancient poets animating all sensible objects, I mean, one thing that I am reading going on there is that this is the Adam and Eve scene right after the creation when they're naming the animals. And Blake is always working in this, throw this beside this, think about this. So he's not telling exactly that story, but he's telling one that's quite similar. So think Adam and Eve here naming the animals. God says, okay, what's this? Giraffe, okay, next. What's this? You know the story. Elephant, okay, next. So Adam and Eve name these things. And Blake is saying these ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods, calling them by names. I mean, the word animate means to breathe life into. By naming them, they're creating them. By speaking the word, they're being brought into existence. That is a performative utterance, to speak something. So what they're doing is what God had just done. Here's Blake's version of that biblical story. God speaks, let there be elephants, and there are. Adam and Eve speak, it's an elephant. And it's an elephant, because they say so. And it's somehow in the act of speaking that, that is the act of God coming into the world again and again and again. And in Blake's view, you have to keep doing that, speaking it, because if you just hang on to the one thing that someone spoke 20 years ago,
then you only have elephants.
Yeah, and you'll never have something besides elephants. So, this one might, there's a bunch of little short ones in here, but where I'd like you to turn to is plate 23, which is Blake's version of the Sermon on the Mount. Part of the trouble with reading Blake, I mean, in snippets or in an hour, is
And I don't even couch myself as an evangelist for Blake. I mean, I'm not. I'm interested in him. But I mean, it's sort of the opposite sometimes happens. People say, oh, this is really weird. I don't get it. I don't think I want to read it. I mean, in some senses, that's not a bad response to Blake. He, as an artist, he wanted to be viewed, certainly, but he only printed up 10 copies of This Marriage of Heaven and Hell. There's more in this room now than he ever printed up in his lifetime. So in some respects, his vision, I mean, he's hoping he can make an artistic contribution, but he doesn't want people to study him, and I don't think get PhDs in him, and preach Blake in wisdom. Well, anywhere, maybe. I mean, what he wants you to do is do what he does. And really, I mean, the best way to teach this class would be probably what I did with the junior minors this morning. And that is, instead of looking at this and making connections to the Bible and talking about performative utterances, I mean, I suppose Blake would roll over in his grave talking about this overanalyzing. But, I mean, what we did, we looked at some of his proverbs, and we just wrote our own proverbs this morning. And, I mean, that response to do it yourself, to speak wisdom, I mean, really is what Blake is after over and over again. And the reason he wants you to do that, he finds in Jesus that that's exactly what Jesus was saying. And the way Blake finds that, partly, is in the Sermon on the Mount. This ties back into the statement we started with, be careful what you hear. So, we're on plate 23. It's a memorable
page
fancy.
43.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So it's a memorable fancy on page 43, ours. Just think Sermon on the Mount here for what you can remember of it, just off the top of your head while you're listening, and see if you recognize this here. Once I saw a devil in a flame of fire, who arose before an angel that sat on a cloud, and the devil uttered these words. Here's the words. Now we know, I mean, when anybody's uttering anything, I mean, things happen. When you utter words, things happen. So this devil utters these words. And the devils are the good guys here. The worship of God is honoring his gifts in other men, each according to his genius, and loving the greatest men best. Those who envy or calumniate great men hate God, for there is no other God. Does that ring any bells from where we even started with? My word, imagination, substituting that for those who have imagination. I mean, to me, this seems like a paraphrase of Jesus. To those who have, even more will be given to them. So this devil is saying, the worship of God is honoring his gifts in other men, each according to his genius, and loving those who have most. He goes on. The angel, hearing this, became almost blue. But mastering himself, he grew yellow, and at last white, pink, and smiling, and then replied, thou idolater, is not God one? And is he not visible in Jesus Christ? And has not Jesus Christ given his sanction to the law of the Ten Commandments? And are not all other men fools, sinners, and nothings? So he's getting a little Calvinism thrown at him. And the devil answered, bray a fool in a mortar with wheat, yet shall not his folly be beat out of him. Now, what's that? Proverb, yeah. I mean, that's a proverb form. In fact, it is a proverb straight out of the book of Proverbs. The only alteration is Blake's weird punctuation that he sticks in the middle of things. But he's taking a proverb right out of the book of Proverbs and quoting back the Bible to someone who's preaching religion to him. He says, bray a fool in a mortar with wheat, yet shall not his folly be beaten out of him. And here's his response. If Jesus Christ is the greatest man, you ought to love him in the greatest degree. So he's following his own wisdom that he had said a minute ago. Now, hear how he has given his sanction to the law of the Ten Commandments. Here's what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount, according to Blake. Did he not mock at the Sabbath, and so mock the Sabbath's God? Murder those who were murdered because of him. Turn away the law from the woman taken in adultery. Steal the labor of others to support him. Bear false witness when he omitted making defense before Pilate. Covet when he prayed for his disciples, and when he bid them shake off the dust of their feet against such as refused to lodge them. I tell you, no virtue can exist without breaking these Ten Commandments. Jesus was all virtue and acted from impulse, not from rules. And this goes on. When he had so spoken, I beheld the angel who stretched out his arms, embracing the flame of fire, and he was consumed and arose as Elijah. Then you get the postscript. Note, this angel, who has now become a devil, is my particular friend. We often read the Bible together in its infernal or diabolical sense, which the world shall have if they behave well. And by infernal or diabolical, again, Blake is meaning its real sense. I mean, this is what Jesus' real wisdom, not religious wisdom. He says, I also have the Bible of hell, which the world shall have whether they will or not. I mean, that's his works that he produces. And then he throws another proverb. One law for the lion and ox is oppression. I mean, again, the interesting thing is, I mean, a proverb, once it's spoken, will always become something that gets collected as a commandment, as a law, and used and quoted by other peoples and to bump you over the head with. And Blake is hoping he can state proverbs here that can avoid becoming affirmative utterances so that we shouldn't go around quoting Blake. One law for the lion and ox is oppression, and someone is oppressing you. I mean, instead, what he'll do is he'll leave that one behind and he'll say something else next. So with the 3 or 4 minutes we've got left, just back to this and the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, if you want to peek at the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5:8, I mean, that's the connection that I would make here. I mean, how would you summarize what this devil's argument is about Jesus that he's making? I mean, irrespective of the exact connection. I mean, what is exactly he saying to this Calvinist who's coming up to him? So you can't beat foolishness out of a fool. He says, Jesus didn't say follow the law.
And this, because he said, it was said, but I say.
Right, exactly.
It was said, don't kill, and I say, even if you hate, you have.
So that's the form of part of the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus is saying, okay, it has long been said that, and then he'll quote some of the law, but now I say to you, And I mean, in some of the traditional terminology we think about that, I mean, there's the law and the gospel being compared. So he's saying, I mean, here's the law, but here's a new way to think about this. It's a gospel. So, I mean, Blake is following that same sort of format here. And he's saying, Jesus didn't preach law. I mean, I think here's where a Lutheran could read Blake and say, yeah, this sounds okay to me, at least some of this. I mean, anything else specifically? I mean, he's going through the commandments and saying, Jesus didn't say follow the Ten Commandments, but he takes that even one step farther. I mean, Blake is always wanting to take things to the shocking conclusion and also to a literal conclusion. And that's where I'll end when I want to point to sort of what the word literal means to Blake. But he's saying, Jesus urged you not just to sort of be freed by this new gospel, but to actually go around breaking all Ten Commandments, because he did that. And then he's got this creative way of explaining one by one how Jesus broke each of the commandments.
You know, the law said kill the woman. He said throw the first stone.
Right. Yeah. So he's running through the list of commandments, and he's doing it in a way that's similar to how Jesus was doing when he was taking the law and psychologizing and internalizing some of that law and making it sort of function in a different fashion. We don't have time to sort of to see how that works, but I do want to point your attention to a couple lines in the Bible and in that speech that Blake does take literally. And it's one of them is in 5:19 in Matthew. And Blake doesn't quote this line, but I think this is what he's doing here in this passage. 5:19 in the Sermon on the Mount says, Jesus says, after he's gone through the Beatitudes and he's starting this, you've heard it said this, but this. He says, therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. That seems fairly, I mean, I know how I would read that. how Blake is reading that, and he's reading the King James version of this, which sounds a little different, but how Blake is reading that, whoever breaks one of these and teaches others to do so will be in big trouble. Blake's saying, right. Whoever breaks one of those will be in big trouble. The moral story is you have to break them all. So that's what his Jesus is saying here. I mean, and it's just taking that line, you could call that literally. I mean, and that's, I mean, Blake, aha, I know what that line in the Bible means. Break them all. So that's what his Jesus here is doing. He's breaking them all. And also one other line, the second half of that one. Does anybody have a King James open by any chance? Read 519 to me in King James. Got any eths and oohs and thous?
Whoever therefore shall break one of the least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom.
Okay, so I mean the second aspect, whoever shall do and teach them, I mean that's what Blake is thinking about. Whoever shall do these things, the focus is always on action for Blake. Whoever does these things that I teach, and what Jesus is doing constantly, Blake says, is speaking. He's telling stories and he's uttering proverbs himself. So what the way Blake is reading the Sermon on the Mount again is a dictum to go out and not try to figure out only just what these parables mean, but to go out and do what Jesus did. Don't necessarily follow the wisdom that Jesus said, follow what he did. He went around speaking wisdom, teaching wisdom, doing things, which Blake is doing. And again, the proper response in Blake's view isn't then just to study Blake or to follow his wisdom, but it's to speak your own and go out and do your own. And in some ways, I mean, it's a recipe for evangelism, but it's an evangelism that remains highly individualistic because you're not going out getting followers, you're just going out preaching. I mean, and that's one of the consequences of Blake's approach, is that it's never going to lead to organized church and the benefits of community that come with that. And I think that, I mean, certainly that's where I, a lot of Lutherans, would break company with Blake. I mean, you can't sit down with a common liturgy with this fashion. But what you can do is certainly speak wisdom and read the Bible energetically